And
bravo.
And thank you all so much for attending today, and as always, all of your interest in this. My sessions often go for almost an hour, and I have Ziv at the back and the timekeeper saying, no, please cut it down. So I have tried to make it a short one this time, and different to what I've done in the past. Let's see if we can get it up. That is me. AI does a lot of wonderful things. Make me look bolder than I already am is one of the magic wonders. Okay, let's get into it. It's right here. I'll just click away like this. Let me try. Here we go. So today I'm talking about buying smart. All the options like this. I've got two talks today. One is in here. The other one I think is at 1:45 p.m. There's a list out the front on the LCD displays about the schedule. That's about financing and borrowing smart. This one is about buying. The ins and outs you need to know about buying a home. I've been doing this for 12, 13 years now, and I focus largely on family homes. So a big thing we want to look at is how you can make the right choice and all the proper information you need to make to find the right home for you. One of the big ones I want to start is you don't want to buy a fantasy home. Okay, buy the home that is useful for the next chapter of your life. And I see this so often. When people start, they go, I want something that is going to be my base in Japan. I will retire. Like when I retire, it will be a fantastic home. But also for the next 20 years, whilst I have my family, it needs to be a really great place for me to raise my kids, close to schools, close to parks. And these are very different stages of your life, raising a family, raising kids, and then retirement. Okay, I'm, you know, midway through raising my kids. I've got three lovely children. I say I had to stutter when I put that in. There's a lot of adjectives I can use for my for my kids. But right now, at this stage of their life, it's being close to schools, being close to elementary schools. The eldest just started middle school. He did the Juken system, which maybe some of you guys either have gone through or have heard about. We went through all of that process. Being part of the community in the local neighborhood. So much of this is important things you need to be considerate about when you have a young family and you're going through this chapter of your life. So trying to find a place that does too many things, it's not really possible. There's not going to be a place that's a great property to raise a family and also a great property as a retirement. And then also get the maximum upside when you sell it as an investment later. You want it to do all of those things really, really well. You're going to have to compromise on each of those factors. Whereas if you find a place that is great for this next 10 to 15 years or maybe 20 years of life, that's a lot more realistic. A lot of my clients, when they're single, maybe buying your own home isn't really the best choice. If you're mid-20s, I think I got a lot of guys here behind the camera, you know, in their mid-20s, that buying a home for yourself right now is probably not a good choice. Renting is fantastic, okay? But if you want to, when it's time to settle down and have a family, so usually late 20s, maybe early 30s, a lot of my clients just gotten engaged, just gotten married. That's when I need a foundation for this next stage of my life. Once you're at that step, the next one is, okay, a house or a mansion. A mansion is easier to manage, but a house gives you a lot more flexibility and freedom. So let me explain. I have a large balcony outside my living room, and I have a big Weber barbecue grill, gas barbecue grill out there, and I enjoy barbecuing regularly. Never in my mind do I think someone is going to complain, or if they do complain, it's not a concern. I just invite them over to the barbecue because there's nobody corporate. There's no management rules that I need to follow, no guidelines or rules that I need to obey outside of general civil societal rules. However, in a mansion, the rules are different. Okay, I recently purchased a holiday home. Maybe some of you, if you follow socials, you've seen I've been going up to Chiba last year quite a bit and looked at a bunch of Akiya as well. And it's a nice big house. They're affordable. They're cheap. But just the maintenance of the garden, okay, or any kind of leaks is like, at the end of the day, I thought, I don't have the capacity to look after that or to manage that. So we ended up getting a mansion by the beach that has a beautiful ocean view. This winter time, I think we didn't go for 3 months at a stretch. But it doesn't matter. I know it's completely fine. I know water's not leaking in there. The garden is not overgrowing. Okay, no one's broken in because it's not on the ground level. There's no insects or whatnot just entering there. No squatter's going to be there. But it has a different need, a different purpose. In Tokyo, I have a house. I like that freedom. I like that the kids can be a little bit noisy. I don't have to worry about disturbing anyone underneath me. So a big part of, I think, the house versus mansion discussion, often when people step into it, they ask, is this going to be a better investment? Which one is worth more when I leave it? Which one's easier to get rid of when I leave? Kind of valid questions, but at the end of the day, the real important thing is, which one do you prefer? What's your own preference? Because this is where you're going to live for the next 10 to maybe 20 years, as I mentioned in the previous slide, you know, if you choose correctly. So there are pros and cons with both. You know, house also has a car parking, which I think is fantastic, you know, if you drive. If you don't, maybe not a point. If you get a mansion, you have to rent the car parking spot. And in this part of town, I think it's anywhere from 40 to 70,000 yen a month is car park rental. And also management fees, they're from 40 to 60,000 yen a month for the homeowners association, HOA fees. I think, you know, different countries have different names for it. Whereas with a house, you're responsible for that yourself. So again, there are pros and cons for each of those. So a new property is easier to start with. A used property, you can get a really good deal if you know what you're doing. But most people don't. And by new, I mean also not just a brand new house, but also what's very, very common recently is renovated mansions, the reform book game. Okay, a renovation company will buy an apartment in Tokyo. They'll renovate it and then resell it. I like those. I think they are fantastic. A brand new mansion has a large premium on it, similar to a house, has a bit of a premium. But the problem with used is it's, although it feels a bit cheaper, renovation costs now are going through the roof. So if you want to do the renovation yourself, it can be quite costly. And a lot of people, again, they think they know what they're doing. I think, who giggled? Was that Blanca that actually giggled at the back? Maybe when I mentioned that. So Blanca, she'll be speaking later today. She does renovations, with Arc Reform right over there. And I think dealing with clients who want to do their ideal renovation, she's experienced, is actually quite challenging. Okay, people trying to do their own renovation can be very, very challenging. Whereas a brand new property, it comes with warranty. It comes with the latest designs, latest finishes, latest fixtures, latest insulation. So personally, both the houses that I've bought have been new properties. Okay, now this one in Chiba, I'm going to have to go through a renovation process. And we've had it for, it'll be a year in August, haven't even started the renovation. And that's been hours of discussion. Whereas if it was a renovated place already, I could go straight in. Anyhow, so yeah, each one comes with trade-offs. And you need to figure out where you are on that spectrum of what you prefer. So there is an important question to ask, is before you buy, is what is the exit strategy? Who will want the property after I leave? For most properties that I deal with, we're in central Tokyo. And there's a lot of desire for properties here. However, when people try to get super budget properties, usually there's something wrong with it. Okay, it's maybe no sunlight. It's like the cheapest property in tucked away in the back corner, or on the first floor, it's really dark. There's a reason it's cheap, right? Or maybe the living room is tiny, like, you know, or maybe there is no dining room. It's just a one little sort of space. No one really wants it after you. It could be very, very unique for your needs. Or, you know, if you build, you know, foreigners often want two toilets in a house. I do tours of some properties, you know, 500 million yen, 700-800 million yen. And it's not until we get about to 600-700 million yen, that's maybe 4 million US, that I'll see a second toilet in a condo, in a mansion. Most houses will have two toilets, but for a second toilet in a mansion, it's like 500 million yen plus is where we start to see it, which is unthinkable in, you know, in Australia and I think in the US. But I had some people that want to build their dream home. They go, we want two bathrooms. And they'll spend a fortune to put a second bathroom up as an ensuite in the master bedroom upstairs. When you want to resell that, the value isn't there. No one's going to price it in the same way. If you want to have, you know, a big spa bath or some other unique thing, just, you know, a soundproof room. Some people like to play instruments and they pay a fortune for making a sound, the Yamaha soundproof rooms. Again, there's no value in that in the resale. So be careful how much you want to spend or invest in a property, because that money may not come back later on. And similarly, if there's something too quirky about it that makes it such a good deal for you, you think this is so cheap because it's the cheapest in the area, it's going to be hard to move, hard to resell. And just this is especially the case in Tokyo. It's not a huge issue. There's big demand in Tokyo. But when you're a bit further out into other prefectures, it can be more challenging when you have this particular setup. Another example is if you go to, like, you know, Ibaraki and you spend 100 million yen on building your dream home, it's going to be really hard to move that in the future. Someone doesn't want to spend $1 million to live in Ibaraki, right? So you also need to think, to a degree, what the exit is going to be. I just had a couple recently who they had purchased a house in Setagaya, actually not far from my house. I actually rode my bicycle the first time to check it out. I got a call from them and they had just bought it. It was a brand new house. They bought it about a year earlier. And then when they walked into the finished product, the husband, who's like twice my height, twice my width, is like, I don't fit in this house. It was a three-bedroom house. The LDK was, I think, about 12 draw, 12 tatami for the living dining kitchen. And each bedroom was about 4.5 draw in size, which is enough for, like, that's basically the size of a double bed. And his wife had shown him the plans, and it's got J, you know, 4.5J, 12J. What on earth does that even mean, right, to someone? He said, okay, yeah, it's fine. And they actually took him to see a model house, the same developer. It was an open house group, which, that's enough said. They took him to see a model house, and he's like, oh, okay, yeah, this is fine, this is great. What he didn't realize was they were just showing him the color selection. That was a house done in the same color, same theme. It wasn't a reflection of the actual size of the property. So during the construction, because they bought it off the plan, he's looking at it, going outside, going, I don't think this is the right size. Anyhow, in the end, once he went in there, he's like, nope, this is not working. So they never even moved in. They said, Emil, we want to sell it. We need to buy something bigger. So we just finished that. I think it was March 31st. We sold it for them. It was brand new. They bought it in August of last year. And we sold it in March. So they never lived in it. Fortunately, the market has sort of moved slightly and they were able to close it at pretty much break-even cost. After their purchase costs and then their selling fees, they sort of broke even up or down about 100,000 yen after paying off the loan. So it was fortunate that it didn't actually cost them anything. But that's one of the things that you need to, you know, understand. So a lot of times I like people to go out and have a look at properties and understand clearly what is the draw, how much size actually matters. In my experience with three little kids, at LDK, you want it to be 16 jaw is a bit small, 18 jaw and above, 18 tatami in size and above is very good. Sorry, this is flickering there as well. Sorry about that. And living rooms, the master bedroom, you want about 7 jaw and up in size. There's not a lot of 10 or 12 jaw master bedrooms that you find. 6 is common, but 7 and above is like 7 to 9, I think, is quite nice. You can fit a queen size bed or a king size bed and maybe some dressers on the side. The closets are not included in the living room space, in the space calculation. So if it says 6 jaw and there's closets in the diagram as well, that's not, the closets are not included in the space. Okay, it's just really the living room space, the living space. The second, third or fourth bedrooms can be 4.5 jaw to 6 jaw in size. That's, I think, acceptable, but you want a master bedroom to be a little bit larger for the couple. It's assuming you want, you know, a family space. And then the fourth bedroom, even 4 jaw, maybe 3.5 as like a little study office and the occasional guest room, okay? So that's my recommendations. When you look on the floor plans and you see what those numbers are, understand sort of what they mean, but definitely go out and look at properties. And once you see, I think, about 5 properties, you can have a good idea of what the floor plan actually says and what it reflects in real life. And when you get good at that, you're able to really filter properties from the floor plan very, very quickly. And I am going to say, for families, living room is more important than bedrooms. It's someone who wants, you know, 7 or 8 jaw bedrooms in each room to be that size, you're not going to get that. Try to get that for a master bedroom, and it's okay to have smaller bedrooms. But a small living room is a deal breaker for a lot of people. Okay, it's all right to have small bedrooms, but a small living room is the key one. So most people invariably end up getting the larger living room space and will go be okay with the smaller bedrooms. But the reverse is not acceptable. Big bedrooms and then just a small living room space ends up not working. Okay. So in Japan, real estate, age, size, budget equal, no, that's wrong completely. Age, size, and location equal your budget. That's a very firm formula. Okay? There are some slight changes, but I'll repeat that. In Japan real estate, the age, size, and location equal your budget. You can have a brand new property and a really, really big size in the center of Tokyo, but your budget is going to be through the roof. And often the budget is the one item that is kind of fixed. You don't have much wiggle room. People don't have an infinite budget. You can have a bigger house as you want. Fantastic. You can choose a location, but unfortunately the budget has very, very little flexibility to go beyond a certain amount. So that means if you want to be closer to the center of town, a great location, and you want a big space, you're going to need to have a older building. I just was showing a client a property in Daikanyama a few weeks ago, and it's overlooking the new Christian Dior building, which they're just building. It's like lovely, like 1 or 2 story sort of building with a bamboo facade, wonderful Japanese garden. I think they just opened it up like 2 or 3 weeks ago, and it's overlooking that. And that was that's a 3-bedroom, I think 75 square meter property. It was 140 million yen, which usually for that size in Daikanyama is about 300 to 400 million yen. The reason it was half the price is because it's a 1978 building. It's before the earthquake regulation changes, which were in 1981. So yeah, great location, great size, but quite old. And as you start viewing properties, this is very much a personal decision. I don't have a exact answer of what the right balance of that equation is for you or for you or for you. It's very personal. But when you start looking, you think, okay, am I willing to go a little bit further out for a little bit more space? And how far out is good? Am I going to cross the river Tamagawa and going to Kanagawa? Do I want to cross the border and go into Saitama? Right? Do I want to be 5 minutes from the station or 15 minutes walk from the station? For me, I like to be, you know, I have that minimum requirement. I've got 3 kids. I have a minimum requirement of size, but I'm in town a lot. So commuting every day, I need to be quite close. Work from home situation has changed that for a lot of people. they can be, they only have to go to the office twice a month. So the commute into Tokyo, like I've got a guy who lives in Nagano, a friend of mine, because he only has to come twice a month to Tokyo. He's completely fine doing that, being the proximity is no longer important. There are some fine details that matter. So sunlight is a big one. If it's a southeast facing corner unit, if it's an apartment building, a mansion, the floor makes a bit of an impact. So yeah, the difference between the fifth floor and the 15th floor is significantly different too. And then land shape. If it's a, with a house, if it's a flagpole lot. By the way, I'll make all these slides available later on, so you don't need to worry about taking photos. You can just focus on the presentation if you like. That's completely fine. But yeah, but often with the house, if it's a flagpole lot at the back, then that is also discounted as well. Some things to look out for, okay? So I've written this tagline at the bottom. So a cheap property is not always a bargain. Okay? Sometimes it's just a problem with a discount. And the ones I talk about are, the key ones are leased land, no rebuild allowed, or built outside of regulation. So leased land, in Japan, we have leasehold and freehold. So if it's a leasehold property, it means you do not own the land. You pay a monthly rent to the landowner, and it could be a 20 or 25 or 30 year lease term. Some of those leases allow you to renew after that period, and you have to pay a renewal fee, similar to a regular rental agreement. However, some of them just say, nope, it's terminated, and you give back the property. You don't own it, right? And that's all priced accordingly. But often we find leasehold is maybe 25% cheaper in value, like a leasehold right is about 25% cheaper in value than a freehold right. And the reason it's cheaper is because a lot of banks won't finance it, or if they do decide to finance, they'll only finance the remaining term of the leasehold. So if there's 18 years left on a 30-year leasehold agreement, they'll say, well, we'll give you a loan for it, but only 18 years, not 35 years. So the mortgage repayment could be really high. So often we don't deal with that. Some places you need permission from the landowner when you do a title transfer, or they need to agree to it. And there are some contracts where it's a 10% fee. Whatever you sell it for, you have to pay them a 10% fee to change the name, which, you know, 20, 30 years ago would have been a few hundred thousand yen. Now it's a few million yen for that same property. Yeah, but it's written into the contract, and you can't really argue it. The no rebuild allowed. So I talked about the flagpole lot. So that's it, right here. I talked about flagpole lots. There are some lots built in the 60s and early 70s where it's two houses or one or two houses at the back of a property, and there's a narrow pathway to get to that lot. If that pathway is less than 2 meters wide, due to sort of emergency evacuation changes and rules, you're not allowed to build on a property that has less than 2 meters of access to the front road. Okay, it's called in Japanese, Saikenchikufuka. Okay? Sometimes some Akiya properties, we've got the Akiya Hub guys talking later, some properties are like that. If it's a more modern property or a brand new property, you're not gonna have that issue, obviously because they've rebuilt it. But if it's one of those older ones, you cannot get permits to rebuild a new property on it. So if it burns down, for example, or collapses or whatever happens, you can't rebuild. It's going to be a vacant lot of land, and that's all. You can renovate it if you like. So there is some value in it. You can rent it out if you like, because then you can get rental income. And the cash flow seems really, really good because you have some little one-room tenants in there, and the cost to purchase it was very, very cheap. Asset tax is also very cheap. So it does have some pros and cons, but you won't get a bank finance for it either. So generally avoid those. Okay. And then the first two are very, very clear, leased land and no rebuild allowed. The third one though is non-regulation structure. And by that I mean it's built beyond the permitted amount on that lot of land. Often when you look at building flyers, it will say, there's a ratio, maybe 50%/100%, or 60%/150%. Okay, that's what the Kenpei Ritsu and Yoseki Ritsu. They talk about the building footprints that can take up as a portion of the land size, or the total floor area as a portion of the land size. So if the maximum you can build on this lot of land is 100 square meters, and you've built a 120 square meter property, right, that's built outside of regulation. In the future, if you want to resell it, right, it's not going to be financeable because a bank won't finance it for you. Right, so with brand new houses don't have this issue, but some older houses are built beyond this regulation. And how they say that in the paperwork is, if you rebuild this house, you cannot build the same size. Okay, that's how it's worded and written. And you can fall in love with it because it feels really cheap online. Right, you look at it and say, disproportionately cheap. If you see something online that is disproportionately cheap for the area, what you should do is look, is it leased land? Is it no rebuild allowed? Or is it non-regulation structure? Okay, they're the key ones. And if it is, I say just generally avoid it. Okay. I don't know if time, 25 minutes, okay, I'm doing good. Okay, so the buying process is both quite straightforward, a bit rush, like it's casual, and then rush, and then sort of calm again. And then all of a sudden you're at a meeting with stamping, more hunkos, more stamps, and then all of a sudden you get a bag, thank you, and the agent leaves, and you realize I just bought a house. It's very, very anticlimactic because there's so much admin, so much paperwork to go throughout the process. So it's important to really understand this sequence. So in step number two, I've written, you start with the pre-approval, okay? You make an offer when you view a property. You sign the contract and pay the deposit. That is the rush process. Once a contract is signed and you've paid the deposit, you're safe because everything is locked in. Then it's just a bunch of administrative work. You need to send the contract to the bank. They need to give a formal approval to you. And then you go sign the bank contract. And then you agree on the settlement date is already agreed when you sign the original contract. Then on settlement day, you all come to our office. We're sitting aside and the judicial scrivener checks your documents. Again, you don't make any decisions at this stage. You're just stamping what the agents tell you to stamp, what the bank tells you to stamp. And the judicial scrivener will check the documents, say, yes, everything is in order. He literally calls the bank and says, yep, everything's in order. The bank says, fantastic. They will transfer the 100 million yen to your bank account. And you know, you'll be sitting there, just at your desk going, oh, have 100 million yen, just came in. Oh, just went out. And the seller is also sitting there at his desk going, yep, 100 million yen, just came in. And the scrivener goes, okay, you've got the money, fantastic. He literally takes all the documentation and goes to the Ministry of Affairs to do the title transfer. That's the process. All you have to do as a buyer is decide your budget, decide on the property. The agent and the bank will, and the scrivener will do all the other work for you. You just need to have your hunko and stamp away. If you're non-resident, you don't need a hunko. You need to get a notarized ID certificate from a notary public in your home country. But that's it. That's in place of the hunko stamp that we use in Japan. But everything else, the local admin support in Japan, the agent, so you have the buyer agent, you have the seller agent, you have the bank, you have the bank scrivener, and you have your buyer scrivener. Okay, so is that four or five different professional entities all working together to make sure you stamp and sign the right documents. That's it. You don't really need to make your own thoughts about it, but just understand there's a process, lots of stamping, but you'll be guided through it, nothing to worry about. Just decide on the budget and the house that you need. Fantastic. So that's it for my presentation. If you are looking for a personal home in Tokyo, if you need a home loan, I'm also a home loan advisor. I've got a talk later today. I think is it 1:45 p.m.? In the 1:15 p.m. in the breakout room just next door, talking about financing and home loans. I'm a certified home loan advisor, so that's also what I help a lot with. Please, yeah, do come out and talk to me. I have a QR code there that goes to my Linktree. It has, my calendar's closed right now because we've been so busy, but all my socials are there. If you want to reach out, the email, just grab me. I can give you my business card and we can have the chat. But thank you so much for your time. Any questions?
Yes, we made the mic in the back here.
Exactly, 30 minutes. How's that? I did a zip.
That was beautiful.
Okay. I'll try to run the mic to you. Just give me a bit of time because this room is a bit heavy up the access. Okay.
And we need maybe something about this constant.
Sorry,
the screen keeps flickering. I think we've got too many. I don't know what's going on. I'll blame Matt at the back.
Awesome. Thank you for your presentation. I thought it was very insightful. I have a question about, you mentioned about the psychic properties. Mm-hmm. So I heard from somewhere that you can negotiate with neighbors to buy like a small portion of like the part that connects to the road and then get it interned into psychic.
Yes.
Is this possible? Is it something that you experienced or done before?
No. So yes, it's possible, but not something I've done. So I've mentioned with the no rebuild allowed properties, if there's less than a 2 meter wide pathway, so 1.5 meters or 1.8 meters is the common sort of size that they used to do in the 60s and 70s, you can maybe buy a portion of your neighbor's lot, like, you know, the other 50 centimeters to make it 2 meters wide. That's definitely possible. But the chance of that happening, I think, is slim because the person there lives there. That could be their house that's literally on that boundary, right? And if they do give it to you, what's their benefit? They're going to have a new construction in the back of their place. And I mentioned before the building rules about how much size you can put on a lot. And that's, you know, if the percent is 100%, you can build 100% floor space based on the size of your land. If you've just given 8 square meters to you, my house could be now 8 square meters built over the regulation. And also, what's in it for them? You need to really have to pay them a lot, which may not be worth the difference for the benefit of acquiring that cheap land. So, yes, technically it's possible. Generally, what's more common is these are houses that are built like in the 60s and 70s. People will just hold the property in the back and wait for it's going to be an old family there because they've had it since the 60s, wait for them to pass away, and the kids are not going to want that property. That land will come up for sale, and then they buy it and redo the whole lot. But it's more a developer or investor strategy, not really an individual strategy.
Right, further questions? Yes, just a second.
Hi, Zain.
Good morning.
And I have some clients who are actually interested in buying condominiums here in Japan, but they are wondering if the monthly fee that they have to pay for the mansion is going to be enough for the Daikibo Shuzen.
Yeah, very, very good question. Yeah, Daikibo Shuzen. That means like the large building maintenance or large scale building maintenance. So sometimes you see a condo, a mansion, will have scaffolding put up all around it and some covers, and they clean it and they paint it, and then the scaffolding comes off and it all looks new. All the windows are either replaced or they're all waterproofed. The corridors are all cleaned inside and they've had a major overhaul. That happens about every 15 years. They do that. And so there's the building funds. When you pay your monthly management fee, you pay the management fee for there's a management company, there's like an old man that sort of hangs out in the lobby, sort of looking at any extra guests that you have, telling you minpakudame or something like that. So you pay him.
Sometimes it's a woman.
Don't. Have I seen any women? No, the women are the concierge ones in the fancy buildings, but it's always an old bloke that looks at you like, yeah, that dude. Yeah, you know the guy. Anyway, you're paying for his livelihood. But also, you pay separately to that the sinking fund, monthly. So when I said before, property management fees or HOA fees are about 40,000 to 60,000 yen. maybe 10 to 20,000 yen of that is management fee, and another 10 to 20,000 yen is a building maintenance or repair fund fee. And then they use this every to do regular pipe cleaning and pipe maintenance, and then the overall building maintenance. And Lenny's question was, if, like, when you buy a building, is the reserve fund that they've accumulated for the past decade enough to pay for this big renovation that they're going to do? And before you buy a property, that is definitely part of the due diligence that you do, especially with, I mentioned some of the old vintage mansions that they refer to them, the pre-81 mansions. Do they have enough money to maintain themselves? So before you buy it, you get a building management report, and it says this is how much money the building actually has right now. And there's also a long-term repair plan, chalk issues and keikaku, long-term repair plan. And it'll say the next 30 to 50 years, it's basically an Excel sheet. And it says every year from, you know, 2020, 2021, et cetera, through to 2070, what their expected repairs are going to be, what the budget allocation or expected cost is going to be for that. And then it has a line chart saying, based on the current funding, this is where our budget is going to be for the next 30 to 50 years. And sometimes that comes up for revision, and more so now because renovation and maintenance costs are increasing. They say, look, with the forecast increase, you see the chart saying the current as-is pricing is will show our budget, accumulated budget go like this. Again, there's some dips when you do the repairs. But when it comes to the big Daikibo Shuzen repair, they're like, we can't afford to do that. So let's have a management agreement or the owner committee agreement. We can increase it by 3,000 yen. There's an option A, increase it by 3,000 yen. Option B, increase it by 7,000 yen, right? And a well-managed property will show all of that, right? So that's all part of the due diligence that you do before. Yeah, so it's definitely an important thing, especially with older properties. But you need to, but it's, you definitely check it and are entitled to check it before you make the purchase.
Further questions? Yes, running to the back.
Yeah. And while you do that, you know, I mentioned I had bought a property in Chigo recently. It didn't have any money, right? So just before I was going to buy one 2 years ago in the same building, and there was this is really cheap. And I looked, they wanted almost 2 million yen per tenant. There's like 100 and plus tenants there. 2 million yen per tenant to do the full building maintenance. It's 40 years old, never been maintained. Some of the concrete was cracking and that all needed to be done. I'm like, wow, that's, you know, almost 30% of the purchase price. So I left it. And then I saw another one come up just after it had been done. The renovations were complete. The repair was done. And I went and I said, has that been paid? And go, yeah, he's paid it. I'm like, oh, okay, fantastic. That's a great deal. So there are situations where the building does not have enough money and they ask everyone, look, we need to pay for some more money, right? We need to collect a bit more money from you. Or there are some buildings that, you know, let's say there's some significant elevator maintenance that's unaccounted for. They'll actually borrow from like Oryx or some kind of financing company. And there's a separate fee that all the owners have to pay off that additional loan. So there are mechanisms in place. But yeah, you can definitely see all of that before making the purchase.
Okay, thank you for the presentation. It's been class. So my questions are around the lot size and the shape.
Hi,
how's it going? So the first one is, you mentioned around like the L-shaped plots not being ideal. And so are there any better plot shapes? Is it just like traditional squares or like rectangle? Like what's kind of an ideal plot shape? And then the other one is related to the percentage of the plot shape covering the land area of the building. And how does that get changed? Is it possible to apply to increase that or change that? Or yeah, just some more details around that would be great.
All right. So in terms of lot shape, if it's like, for example, like a square lot or a corner lot is very usable. There's nothing awkward. So if he says 100 square meters and it's square, you can really utilize most of that space. If you bring the house forward, there's room for a garden area that's, you know, equal to like the amount of space you have there. If it's a triangle lot and you have this little wedge in the corner, although it says it's 20 square meters, it's 20 square meters of not really functional area. So that's kind of what I mean. The properties, the flagpole lots, which have like a long driveway and the house at the back, they are a bit cheaper because that is not, you can't really build on that driveway space as such. So although it says it's 100 square meter lot, the usable space at the back is only 80 square meters. You can technically build according to the ratio based on 100 square meter lot, because it is 100 square meters. You don't have to put it evenly across the property. My family home is a bit like that. But for me, I actually wanted that because I've got three kids. We have five bicycles. Two kickboards and a pogo stick. Now, if we just had a regular house in Setagaya with one car park, you have to like scuttle through to the car to get to the front door. There's no room for five bicycles and the two kickboards and a pogo stick. So for me, when I bought a place, I wanted something like that. One, it's generally cheaper as well because it's the rear lot. So there's more value there. And you have a little bit more privacy. My Amazon deliveries can be just left at the front door and people have to go past all that, you know, it's like a gladiator pit to get to the front door. I got three kids, trust me, it's chaos. So yeah, there are sort of pros and cons with it, but that's the value generally is just a front facing, lots of street access is where it's good. Now, in terms of the Kempeiritsu and Yosekiritsu, the zoning that you're talking about, in general, you can't change that. It's like this whole area is a mid-density residential area. So if I go here and every place is two-story houses, then it's a two-story zoned area. There could be a height restriction, but generally the building footprint can only be 50 or 60% of the land size, or usually 40 to 50% of the land size. And the total floor area of the first floor, second floor combined can be only up to 100% of that area. You have buildings like this across the road or even this one. These are in the thousands. The floor space can be in the thousands because it's more than 10 times the footprint of the land.
All right. One last question, folks, and then you can grab a meal in the back room or at the Q&A session at the end of it.
In the case of mansions, does land always belong to the owners of the mansion collectively? So let's say down the road, in the US, we have the concept of condominium versus co-op. And the difference between condominium and co-op is that the land is owned by the owners of the individual units, right? Whereas co-op, it's the land is owned by somebody else. So do you ever see a leasehold situation in the case of a mansion?
Yes. So there are some occasions where it's a leasehold on the mansion. And when you think the leasehold, often what happens, it's a local temple or a shrine that used to own, or that still owns this land, and they've decided to release some of it for rent, but they still own it. But it's pretty safe because they aren't going to kick you out or have you not, like they're not going to dispute the renewal in general. So the temple-owned land is, I feel, generally the one that it's okay if it's a leased land. But yeah, there are some situations with leasehold, but in general, I avoid them anyway. But the most commonly is just freehold. So when you have a mansion, how it says, let's say there's 1,000 square meters of property, and you have 150 square meter apartment. You have the penthouse. You have 150 square meter apartment in that 1,000 square meter total building. So you own 15% of the building, of the land that's owned there. They generally go by, they'll calculate what's the total building size, square meterage, what's your personal owned size, and that's the ratio. So if you have a 150 square meter property and someone else next door has a 75 square meter property, they'll have half the ownership as what you have. And that's pretty straightforward. And that's also in the documents. When you get the sales flyer and you see the price, it'll say land ownership. And it'll say like you own 2,115 out of, 102,000 units. That's how they break it down. It's really detailed. Yeah. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Emil.
All right. Excellent. Thank you so much for your time. I will be hanging around. I loiter a lot in the foyer and on the terrace. And we do have, this is all about buying a home and the ins and outs of homes. I do have the breakout room. Is it 1:15? There's a schedule on the LCD displays out here anyway, or on the website, summit.realestate.jp. I have a breakout room that was going to talk about home loans and financing. That's focused more on residents, not non-residents. We have Mark Drapkin from Yen Loans, I think tomorrow. He's speaking about non-resident financing, and Alicia as well, non-resident financing. So we have different groups to talk to about that. Thank you very much, everyone.